rubbing them against the abrasive sand, and at last wringing them out. Then, half dry, we would re-enter them, hoping that the heat of our bodies would complete the job before the rain returned. The beach was crowded with naked marines, flailing their clothes against the ocean, their bodies incredibly white, for the rains in that sunless, dehydrating jungle had long since drained all color off. Among them stood Kolo, his body brightly black against that background. They eyed him curiously. When he brought the clothes to me, I heard a whoop of derision, and then the rough, unmistakable shout of the chuckler.
"If that don't beat the hell out of me, look at him, will ya? Look at him! The lousy rear echelon bastard! If he ain't gone and got himself a Batman, I'm gonna write his old man and tell him it's okay to send that blue uniform now."
Kolo withdrew as they came up the beach and gathered around me laughing. I started to retort, but at that moment, the sky darkened and the rains fell again. A general cry of rage and despair rose from the beach. We sat there in disgust. Finally, the Hoosier got to his feet. "Shoot me," he pleaded.
"Why didn't somebody be a good guy and shoot me?"
He looked despairingly at the ocean, turned steely gray again and dimpled by the raindrops, and then glanced down at his own half-dry clothing.
"Hell's fire," he swore. "What's the use of waiting?"
And ran like a madman straight into the ocean. In the morning, I lost my Batman. The officers came and took Kolo away from me. They needed him to serve in the officers' mess that they had contrived for themselves, erecting it almost the very day after the securing of our position. An officer's mess is one of the surest barometers of military success. So long as the officers continue to picket with the men, there is danger of defeat. But once the officer's mess appears, raised almost on the bodies of the foe, contrived of sticks and pieces of canvas, or perhaps only an imaginary line like a taboo, once this appears and caste is restored, we know that victory is ours. That same morning, our 81mm mortars ranged in on an eastward-lying spot believed to be the position of the mysterious enemy artillery. Their guns never spoke again. Our patrols were probing further and further in every direction. To the east, in thickest jungle, Lieutenant Racehorse, the same who placed Chuckler, Chicken, and me in that tiny brig aboard the Manura, killed one Jap while leading a patrol. To the south, Lieutenant Commando ran into an enemy 20mm gun outpost and killed two of them. Further south, to Lout, Lieutenant Liberal, a new officer, killed a Jap on patrol. In the same direction, a 50-man patrol of ours destroyed a 3-man enemy ambush, blasting them with shotguns after the poor silly Japs had shouted out in their precise English, "Come here, please! Come here, please!" Again to the south, to Sag-Sag. A patrol passed the plateau where I had had my own encounter. We had to hold our noses passing the white moving mass of corruption which these bodies had become within a few days. To the north, a few days later, Lieutenant Racehorse contacted a friendly patrol from our main body at Cape Gloucester and conducted them to our perimeter. Finally, far to the south, Lieutenant Commando was wounded by a Jap sniper in a jungle flare-up between his patrol and an enemy force composed of Nipponese soldiers, scout dogs, and natives armed with bows and arrows. Because he was so big, he could not be carried the 6 or 7 miles of rugged terrain lying between Lout and our position. A runner was sent back, and I was in the CP at the time of his arrival. We went to rescue Commando in an amphibian tractor, sailing along the coast under a mackerel sky, a flight of scavenger birds accompanying us like ghoulish outriders over the bleak cliffs to our left. Commando lay in the forward part of the tractor on the return journey, his face ashen and his lips tightened against the pain. Commando might sit on his brains, but he fought with his heart. 4 days later, on the 11th of January, we struck our lines and marched up the coastal track to Cape Gloucester, along the shore, past the wrecked barges, through the empty villages, through the ocean with rifles at high port, and up a beach of smooth white stones, and so to the airfield, back to the warmth and comfort of our division comrades. 4. I had spent the night beneath a native hut, protected from the pelting rain, damp, if not dry, but at least not drenched. When I awoke, I could hardly see. Something was wrong with my eyes. It was as though the lids were stuck together. I blundered out into the light and strained to see my comrades, and soiled ponchos arising from the wet earth like genies swirling into shape from the mist, and saw that they were laughing at me and pointing at me. I felt my face, and found my lips had swelled like a Ubangi woman's, and that my eyelids too had ballooned, as well as my nose. Someone took a mirror from his pack and handed it to me, and I saw myself a puffy gargoyle. But my face subsided to normal proportions within a half hour. I ascribed the swelling to some obscure bug that dwelt beneath that unsavory hut, and forgot about it. But now I remember. Now I remember that here marked the midway point of the battle with the jungle. For the Japanese had been defeated during our solo mission down the coast, and even though the stiffest fight, the 7th Regiment's conquest of Hill 660, would require another week for its consummation, it was the jungle, and not the Jap, that was now the adversary. The puffing of my lips and eyes symbolized the mystery and poison of this terrible island. Mysterious. Perhaps I mean to say New Britain was evil, darkly and secretly evil, a malefactor, an enemy of humankind, an adversary, really, dissolving, corroding, poisoning, chilling, sucking, drenching, coming at a man with its rolling mists and green mold and ceaseless downpour, tripping him with its numberless roots and vines, poisoning him with green insects and malodorous bugs and treacherous tree bark, turning the sun from his bones and cheer from his heart, dissolving him, the rain, the mold, the damp steadily plucking each cell apart like tiny hands tearing at the petals of a flower, dissolving him, I say, into a mindless, formless fluid, like the sop of mud into which his feet forever fall in a monotonous slop, suck, slop, suck. That is the sound of nothingness. The song of the jungle, wherein everything falls apart in hollow harmony with the rain. Nothing could stand against it. A letter from home had to be read and reread and memorized, for it fell apart in your pocket in less than a week. A pair of socks lasted no longer. A pack of cigarettes became sodden and worthless unless smoked that day. Pocket knife blades rusted together. Watches recorded the period of their own decay. Rain made garbage of the food. Pencils swelled and burst apart. Fountain pens clogged and their points separated. Rifle barrels turned blue with mold and had to be slung upside down to keep out the rain. Bullets stuck together in the rifle magazines, and machine gunners had to go over their belts daily, extracting and oiling and reinserting the bullets to prevent them from sticking to the cloth loops. And everything lay damp and sodden and squashy to the touch, exuding that steady, musty reek that is the jungle's own, that individual odor of decay rising from vegetable life so luxuriant, growing so swiftly, that it seems to hasten to decomposition from the moment of birth. It was into this green hell that we were inserted a day or two after the march from Tuwali Sagsag, and here was fought that battle with the rainforest. Here the jungle and the men were locked in a conflict far more basic than our shooting war of the Japanese, for here the struggle was for existence itself. The war was forgotten. Who could comprehend it? Who cared? The day was but 24 hours, and the mind had but 2 or 3 things to command it. Objects like dryness, food, oh, most of all, most unbelievably of all, a cup of hot coffee, a clean, dry pair of pants, and a place out of the rain. Hours passed in precocious contemplation of that moment just before darkness when, with cigarette wrappings and the wax paper covers of the K-rations, with matches carefully wrapped in a contraceptive and kept within the liner of the helmet, a tiny fire was lighted and water heated in a canteen cup, and thus was the belly fortified to face the cold black night. Once we had taken up these new positions, featureless in my memory, except that a narrow but swift little stream swept through the battalion CP, I resigned myself to the dreary proposition that I would be wet so long as I stayed on New Britain. I would be wet, not only from the rain, for sometimes it stopped, and at other times it did not fall so fast that a jungle hammock could not repel it, but because an affliction which had begun the moment I left Australia was now active again. It had begun during the discomforts of Guadalcanal, had disappeared in the civilized living of Melbourne, and had reappeared on Goodenough, New Guinea, and now on New Britain. I learned later from doctors to call it enuresis. When one is asleep, the bladder empties. And that is that. Our patrolling recommenced, for the Japanese had been put to flight now, and our patrols were engaged in annihilating them, small unit by small unit, as they were encountered wandering in the rainforest. Small, quick actions were common. Here a patrol would destroy a half dozen Japanese, sometimes losing one or two of our own in killed or wounded, and here another would surprise a larger group of the demoralized Tan men, or perhaps blunder into one of their ambushes. But running through this irregular rhythm of patrol action was the regular measure of attrition. The enemy, to use the Hoosiers' phrase, was being whittled. Days made uneasy with the anxiety of patrolling were capped by nights filled with the apprehension of infiltration by the foe. Not to say that the Japanese was a bloodthirsty human, alive only to the chances of killing. Rather, the very disorganization of his forces made him more to be feared at night, for he would prowl within our lines, hungry for food, and when detected, fight for his life. The thought of a softly infiltrating enemy lay uppermost in our minds during the night watches, especially during a man's careful progress from jungle hammock to sentry post. On the night of a heavy storm, it was on my mind when I had finished my sentry trick and climbed into my hammock, lying there half awake, half asleep, my knife held loosely in my hand, when suddenly I heard a scream not 6 feet away. I turned to see, by the light of a lightning flash, turned to see two dark figures flailing against each other before both fled and darkness reclaimed the field. The CP was in a turmoil. Voices rose, inquiringly, querulously, and I could distinguish among them the cry of one of them from my section.
"Japs in the CP?"
Then another familiar voice.
"A Jap just tried to get me!"
I let myself down from my hammock, switching my knife to my left hand, groping from my machete lying against a tree, shouting,
"Over here! Over here! I saw him!"
In the quiet that followed, there rose the bellow of the major, commanding,
"Don't shoot! Get him with your bayonets!"
And then, in the ensuing silence, there was the distinct, the unmistakable, the lucid clicking of a hammer as the major cocked his pistol. "Ah, yes. Get him with your bayonets, lads. Don't shoot, lads. You may hit the major." Click. Click. I went back to bed and listened to the storm of wind and the storm of commands and counter-commands raging around me until one or the other or both subsided, or else I fell asleep. In the morning, it became clear that the two men of my section who claimed to have encountered the Jap prowler had really run into each other. They had not been fond of each other before this incident, but thereafter they made a cult of their dislike. At last we were withdrawn from this miserable morass, and we took up new positions. We slopped through a soup of mud that had once been a dirty road, and on our way we were joined by Eloquent, who had fetched Chicken and me from the brig, who now had come to Cape Gloucester from the battalion rear echelon on Goodenough, He told us the first sergeant back there had killed himself. He grew despondent one night, Eloquent said, and shoved the muzzle of a Tommy gun into his mouth and pulled the trigger. A most messy end of himself. None of us could comprehend it. We were now in reserve. We no longer had a front to defend, but we had a new enemy, the trees. Our position lay in a blasted wood so grim, so stark, so scarred that it might have been the forest of the moon. The Japanese had defended here, and a fierce artillery barrage had been laid in on them. Our shells ravaged that forest of giant trees. They lay uprooted, or stood broken and splintered, limbs dangling like broken arms, or decapitated, with their foliage tops lolling over like a poorly cut head. Or they listed, weakened by cannon fire and water-soaked with rain. Through the day and the night, this grotesque forest resounded to the crash of falling trees, and no less than 25 men were killed by them, crushed to death. An equal number were injured. And once, when we began to dynamite them, we killed another man, to prove that a bad cure can be as deadly as the cause. A great boulder fell on him as he sat beside his hammock. We all mourned him, for he was the buffoon of the battalion. He was the nearest thing to a fat man I ever saw in the Marine Corps. He was not really fat, loudmouth, but heavy-jowled and of pinkish complexion that always seems to bespeak obesity. Without age, without gifts, without authority, a fat man has no chance. Poor loudmouth had none, even though he was intelligent and sensitive. So they were always at him, and when he sought to retaliate by assuming a superior air, the jibes and taunts turned his foolish vanity against him. He liked to strut, and to pretend that he was above the humdrum or the hazards of our daily life. He was fond of saying things that could enforce that pose. Me? I'm gonna be in B Company. I'm going to be here when you leave, and be here when you don't come back. Next war, boys, there's going to be two persons missing, me and the MP they send after me. So a boulder crushed the life and the pitiful boasting out of him. We felt sad, because Loudmouth had always seemed so much a waif, so forlorn. The others might die beneath the falling trees, the widowmakers, as we called them. And no one would feel melancholy, but with Loudmouth, it did not seem fair. Loudmouth never seemed really to be involved in the war. He seemed more spectator than participant. And that was how he died, as though a foul ball had risen from behind home plate and brained him. He sat beside his hammock, and a boulder blotted him out. The last patrol was a prolonged one of several days. We were taken by landing boat down the east coast to a place called Old Natamo, and there deposited. The place had once been inhabited by the Japs, but all of their emplacements were now empty. Those of the enemy who were discovered were in the last extremities of ordeal. Some were overtaken crawling on their hands and knees, some so badly decomposed it was as though their feet were rotting off. Some weighing perhaps no more than 80 pounds, some without weapons, all without food, and all possessed of that indomitable fighting spirit that was the Japanese Imperial Army's greatest asset, the one single factor that made a poorly equipped soldier a first-rate foe. They all resisted, and they were all destroyed, bayoneted for the most part. For it was folly to fire a rifle on patrol in unfriendly, unknown territory. One of these stragglers was strangled in cold blood by the Kid, a youngster who, although already a veteran of Guadalcanal, was hardly acquainted with a razor. He was to go mad 2 months later. So we mopped up. At night, a fierce rainstorm blew, and we huddled beneath the lean-tos we had built along the shore. In the morning, it was still raining, but the sea had deposited a gift on our doorstep. The rain had caused a flash flood to sweep the forest of the Widowmakers, where our comrades reposed, and all of their food had been carried away to the beach, where it was swallowed by the sea. but the sea had coughed it up again on our strip of sand. We fell upon this donation of Neptune with whoops of delight. Even though the food was of common fare, cans of dried eggs, dried milk, sugar, coffee, dehydrated vegetables, syrup, it appeared to us the makings of a banquet, for we could use it as we wished, and in whatever quantities we wished. Had we known that this was the lost food of our buddies, I suspect it would have tasted even better. We ate pancakes, fried in our mess gear, and drank coffee all that day, for it was storming intermittently, and we did not go patrolling. Next day, on a short patrol inland, I found a Japanese chest and carried it back with the help of Playboy. Solidly built, it was just the thing to hold my clothes and my books, which my father had now begun to send me from the States. I had perhaps a dozen books now, among them a dictionary and an almanac, two works which sufficed to establish me as the sage of the 2nd Battalion, 1st Marines. Many disputes were referred to me in my books of wisdom, with a confidence as unwarranted as the conceit it produced. In combat, my books were kept in company property, but presently, since we had come off the lines, I had reclaimed them, and the chest would make a magnificent locker library. The landing boats came for us the next day, and we piled aboard, Playboy and I carrying the Japanese chest between us. On our return, we found the battalion busily picking up and bidding goodbye to that blasted, unhappy forest, and moving to a new area where we were provided pyramidal tents and began to live with some degree of comfort. Our comfort invited visitors. One morning, the artist reached for his poncho under his cot and found a bushmaster coiled beneath it. He seized his carbine and shot the snake through its horribly beautiful head. It measured about 10 feet. A week after our arrival, Lieutenant Big Picture came to our tent and commandeered my chest. He took it in my absence. I would like to say stole, but I have already said commandeer, which is the word for official stealing. Grinding my teeth, I went down to see Big Picture in the section tent. It would be an unequal contest. It would be no contest. I would reason, he would command, and I would lose my chest, from which he had removed my books and clothes, casting them contemptuously on my cot. But I would still like Big Picture to see my face. The artist says you have my chest, I began. He looked at me coldly and said nothing. I ground my teeth and smiled. Are you just borrowing it, sir? I'm taking it. We need it in headquarters to store the gear in. I followed his eyes and saw the chest. In one corner of it reposed our meager map-making gear. In the other, Lieutenant Big Picture's clothing. An insane rage swelled within me. Ivy League stealing cigars. Major share, taking all the bacon out of the battalion ration. The officers kidnapping Kolo. And here, Big Picture stealing my chest. He spoke again. You know an enlisted man can't have a thing like that in his tent. What could I say? This thing within me was bursting to be free and to do violence. My insides were like a cavern in which a chained demon bellowed and clamored, and I dared not speak for fear the sound of my own voice would set it free. I could only look at Big Picture and let my face tell him that I wanted to kill him. And then I left him. Next day, the map-making gear was back on the ground, and the chest was in Big Picture's tent, filled with his clothing and personal articles. The chest became a fixation with me, and the insult and injustice ballooned far beyond proportion. I talked stupidly about killing Big Picture, being careful to say the most dire things in the presence of those closest to him, men who would be sure to repeat my words to him. It was all talk, big, empty, windy talk. But it had the desired effect. In a few days, Big Picture sent an emissary to my tent. He chose well, for his spokesman was the gambler, perhaps the best-liked man in the battalion. A tough man across the poker table, the gambler was a soft touch in his position as battalion quartermaster. What's eating you, kid? What's all this crazy talk about killing Big Picture? He laughed as though it were all a joke, and I laughed too. Who told you? Who told me? Don't make me laugh. You've practically got it written in neon on your back, I'm gonna get big picture. His tone changed and he spoke earnestly. Come on now, kid. You oughtn't be talking like that. Somebody's liable to take you seriously, and you've got poor big picture going nuts. I hope they do take me seriously. And I hope that lousy little shavetail blows his stack. What have you got against him? He stole my footlocker. Gambler grinned. How do you mean, stole? Where'd you get it? I know what you mean, I said. But the Japs can come and take it back any time they want. I said he stole it, and that's what he did. He said he was taking it for the section property, but he's using it to keep his clothes in. Though warned that Big Picture might take reprisal, I remained stubborn. The gambler's visit only made me apprehensive. I was relieved when, a few minutes later, Eloquent and the Playboy came into the tent and suggested a swim at the waterfall. The waterfall lay upstream of the narrow river that ran behind our tents. It fell about 15 feet into a deep and foaming pool. About a third of the way down it, and behind it, was a hollow space in the rock. You could climb down to it and then, standing on a smooth stone platform, dive into the waterfall. The moment you entered that downpour of water, it took hold of you, forcing you to fall like a stone into the cold pool, down, down, down into the blackness and the thrill of fear when the lungs begin to strain and the legs start kicking, breaking your descent, thrusting frantically now for the surface and the good sweet air and the roar of the falls and the sound of voices. But this day, on my first dive, I felt a sudden pain in my lower regions. Perhaps it was a minor rupture, or the sign of an incipient one. On Guadalcanal, I had felt similar pains while burying the heavy crates of ammunition. But there had been no hope of treatment there, and I had ignored it. Here it was again, though, and it worried me. It was difficult to walk. There was a heavy sensation. Playboy helped me back to the tent. Still, I did not want to turn into the hospital, hoping that the affliction would disappear. But when I got there, I changed my mind. Big Picture wants to see you, said the artist. He's going to put you into the galley. What happened to you? I said, I think I got myself a big fat rupture. What's so funny about that? It means I won't be going to the galley, and I can't wait to tell Big Picture. I hobbled down to sickbay. The doctor examined me and began writing on a blue ticket. What's that, sir? I asked. Evacuation order. They can't do anything for you here. I'm evacuating you to New Guinea. Report here in the morning with your toilet gear. What a pretty blue ticket. What a lovely way to run a war. I eyed it like a prisoner receiving his pardon and set off for Big Picture's tent. Did you want to see me, sir? I could not have been more respectful. His face was bleak, his tone resentful. Yes. Get your gear and report to the mess sergeant. You're going into the galley. But sir, I said with plaintive respect, I thought that intelligence personnel were exempt from galley duty. That's one of the benefits you talked about when you asked me to join the section. He avoided my eyes, but his voice was filled with the determination of revenge. Not anymore. From now on, we have to provide a man, and you're it for the month of March. Gee, sir, that's too bad. What's too bad? He repeated angrily, looking at me fiercely. I can't go. I have to go to the hospital. He was so plainly frustrated and consumed with rage that it was embarrassing. I had come to gloat, but I could only hope that he would terminate the interview and let me free. What the hell do you mean, go to the hospital? Who the hell says so? I'm your commanding officer. The doctor down at sick bay says I have a rupture, I said, withholding the part about evacuation to New Guinea. No sense risking things, I would tell the battalion sergeant major in the morning before I left. It may have to be operated on, I added, just to fortify my position. Now it was Lieutenant Big Picture who did the staring. He gazed at me with unconcealed hatred, but with far too much sullenness for a person accustomed to the upper hand. All right, he said. I'll take care of you when you come back. You may think you've beaten me this time, but you're still going into the galley. Yes, sir, I said. May I go now? The big transport plane rose with a roar from the airstrip at Cape Gloucester, and I settled with relief into my bucket seat while the plane leveled out to fly low over the Dampier Strait, and then gained altitude over New Guinea, where the jungle had the appearance of row upon tightly packed row of Brussels sprouts. Our airplane came down with a rush at Cape Sud-Est. There was a khaki-colored ambulance waiting for us. We were in the hands of the army now. We were being taken to one of their station hospitals. The ward was in a Quonset building. A nurse, the first woman I had seen in nearly 6 months, gave me pajamas and assigned me to a cot. 2 or 3 days passed like an idol, reading, eating 3 fine meals a day, going to movies at night, and then came my examination. The doctors decided that they did not want to undertake such an operation in the tropics, nor did they consider the affliction serious enough to send me farther back to a general hospital in Australia or the States, even if they had had the authority to do so. I was dejected. Back to Cape Gloucester and Big Picture's revenge, and goodbye to the hospital library. But with nightfall, the future changed again. I came down with malaria. Never again may I have recourse to such a malignant savior. I was delivered from mess duty and the persecuting revenge of Big Picture, but the fires that racked me and made of my body an oven were such as to make me wish for a year in the galley and 12 Big Pictures to command me. But of course I wished for no such thing. I wished only for release from this fiery vice. And if death were the only release, then I wished for death. To lie on my back was torture. To lie on my stomach, a torment. I tried to lie on my side, but even here my bones ached as though they were being cracked in the grip of giant pliers. I could not eat. I could not drink. Not even water. They fed me through the veins, intravenously, for I do not know how long. 10 days? 2 weeks? All the time I lay baking. Not burning or flaming, understand, but baking, as though I were in an oven. Feeling the will to live shrivel within me, yearning only for a tiny trickle of sweat to burst from my desiccated flesh. Hearing people alive and talking around me, the touch of the nurse, the momentary cool of the alcohol being rubbed upon my back like a blissful reminder of the world I had left. But comprehending nothing, lying there, only a rag of aching bones slowly shrinking in the glowing oven of malaria. Then the fever broke. Sweat poured from my pores like a balm. It bathed my body in a blessed cool, and I could laugh, sing, shout, if only I had the strength. It seemed ungrateful to lie there as the liberating fluid flowed from my body, not to make some sign of thanks. But I was too weak to move. Like an atheist who has no God to thank for present favors, and because I had so far forgotten my own religion, I felt no impulse of mental thanksgiving. The sweat soaked my bedclothing, and the nurse, happy to see my ordeal ended, moved me with smiles to another cot. I soaked this one too, and then came the chills. I kept on shivering, and they piled the blankets higher over me. It was well over 100 degrees outside, but they covered me with blankets, as though it were only a quarter of that, and I still shook. But this I did not mind. I could even smile. Like the runner, grinning with quivering lips, it feels so good. It feels so good. It was over. But several more days were required before I could sit up or take food. The smell of food nauseated me. Tea and a slice of toast were all that I could bear. Finally, I ate with the rest of the patients. And I can remember the extreme effort needed to insert the first forkful of food into my mouth. But in a week, I was leaving the hospital. Back to an evacuation point on the beach, and thence to Cape Gloucester via a nocturnal crossing of the Dampier Strait in a converted fishing schooner. A storm broke upon our heads. Black water came over the sides, flooding the deck where we slept. and we retreated to a cabin where we spent the night. Half of these ambulatory patients seasick by the dizzy rise and fall of our puny craft. Fate chided me gently upon my return to Cape Gloucester. Most of the battalion was away on an extended patrol. Lieutenant Big Picture among them. And the battalion sergeant major, seeing that I was still weak, kindly gave me light duty in the senior NCO's mess. So my flight to New Guinea was almost futile. The threat of rupture was still with me. I had gained a delay only by being felled by that filthy bout of malaria, and here I was on mess duty to prove how presumptuous can be the private who believes he can accomplish anything by himself. But there was nothing to this assignment, merely a matter of keeping the tent clean, brushing the crumbs from the rough wooden table, and setting out the places for the handful of men who had not gone on patrol. They helped themselves, eating in a sort of buffet from the pewter containers of food sent over from the main galley. In a few days, the battalion returned, with only a few wounded, and I was overjoyed to hear that Big Picture had been transferred, and that our new section commander was Liberal, the young second lieutenant who had distinguished himself by killing a Jap on his first patrol. 2 or 3 more weeks passed in lolling about our tent area. We began to play bridge. We played obsessively, pausing only for meals or sleep so as to gain sustenance or refreshment for playing more bridge. Some of us even began to think in bridge terms, of finessing or reneging or cross-ruffs, and the breaking point of our mania was reached one night when the gambler, exasperated by the play of a poor partner, rose up wrathfully to tear up the only deck of cards we possessed and to overturn the candles. But no one minded, for we were leaving the next day, as the gambler well knew when he made his disgust so flamboyant. An army unit was arriving as we were departing. There were hoots and mock falsettos from our raggedy ranks when we perceived the first equipment to be deposited on the beach. Stoves and suitcases. And then we were marching aboard the LSTs, the now familiar Trojan seahorses, and leaving that accursed island forever. We were going. As they say in the song, we don't know where we're going, but we're going. Chapter 7. Victim. 1. All the way from New Britain there had been foolish, hopeful talk of going home. All the way we had indulged in silly speculation on the impossibility of sending our disease-decimated division into action again without arrest in Australia or New Zealand, if not back in the States. All the way we had pointed to our emaciated frames and rotting legs and festering armpits, and then, arguing out of jaundiced lips and prejudiced hearts, had pronounced ourselves unfit. All the way there had been the erection of castles in air upon the cobweb of the government's new troop rotation plan, and the single fact of our having served the required 2 years overseas. All the way high hearts and foolish hopes. And now, Pavuvu. "What is it?" asked Eloquent. When first we heard the island's name from Lieutenant Liberal, "What in the name of heaven is Pavuvu? A tropical disease? Like the Mumu?" "It's Pavuvu with a capital P," said Lieutenant Liberal reprovingly. "So? It's a place. It's where we're going. Pavuvu Island in the Russells, part of the Solomons." "Sounds poetic," said Playboy dreamily. "Oh, I'll bet it is," said Eloquent with heavy sarcasm. "The wind sighing gently in the palm fronds, white beaches kissing the blue sea, undulating island beauties coming down to meet us with songs and lays." "Lays? Who's getting lays?" "Songs and lays," Eloquent continued, loftily ignoring the interruption. "Oh, it'll be peachy dandy. When do we get to this wretched place, Lieutenant?"
"Tomorrow," said Liberal.
We marched ashore in the rain and inched up a mud-slicked slope into a coconut grove, and there sat down to contemplate our misery. This was our new home. Pavuvu was to be our rest area.
Here we were to make ready for our next campaign. Instead of a machete, we were given shovels and buckets. There was no underbrush to be cleared. But there was ubiquitous mud to be conquered by quarrying uncounted tons of coral from an open cut in a hill opposite us. We shared Pavuvu with multitudes of rats, and these too we set to conquering with our busy American ways. But soon our supplies of poison ran out, and the piles of little carcasses became more obnoxious in their state of stinking corruption than the live rats had been in pelting flight across our tent tops. When dusk set a limit to our assault upon mud or rat, a soft rustling in the palm fronds suggested a more exotic foe, for then we would see the darkly beautiful bat stretching its silent wings upon the winds of evening. In the end, it was only the mud we conquered. We left the rats alone and never bothered the bats, only wondering sometimes where the rats came from. And if it were the palm fronds, as many believed, how did they get along with their laconic neighbors, the bats? The food was bad, too, and our tents were rotten and punctured with holes. There was no water except what was caught in our helmets during the night. We bathed by dashing naked into the rain, soaping ourselves madly in a race against the probability of the rain ceasing and being left streaked with sticky soap. And we washed our clothes by boiling them in cans of rainwater. Our jungle rot had become so bad, so persistent, that there was an appointed time each afternoon for the men to take off shoes and socks and to lie on their sacks with corrosive feet thrust out into the sun. But we had borne all this before, and we could bear it again. Nor could mere bad food or leaky tents press upon the ardor of my comrades. It was the death of hope that bore us down. There had always been hope. Hope of relief. Hope of the sun. Hope of victory. Hope of survival. But when they came and told us that none of us were going home on rotation, we strangled hope and turned into wooden soldiers. The future looked to innumerable enemy-held islands and innumerable assaults, and we had already noticed how the ranks of the New River Originals were dwindling with every action. There were even a few suicides to suggest how despairing some could find the situation. We lay on our sacks and listened to the rain or the rats and contemplated some drab substance the color of gray. Then the thing changed. They came and said half of the originals could go home. There was joy. And then, once the method of selection for the stateside bound became known, there was anger. There would be a drawing, a stateside lottery, in which men's names would be pulled from a hat, but only the names of those who had never been in trouble. I was among those whose name did not go into the hat. And so were Runner, and Hoosier, and Chicken, and Souvenirs, and a host of others. It seemed that the originals of the 2nd Battalion 1st Marines had been neatly divided into good guys and bad guys. Among us there raged a profane anger. I know now how a convict must feel upon being turned down at job after job because of his past. That was what disqualified us. Our past. It made no difference that we had been punished. Yes, punished again and again, for it had become customary to solve all problems of selection this way, by marking brig rats for dirty duty and excluding them from special benefits. Nor did it matter that we had good war records. It must have been even harder for a third group, a few men, like the artist, whose skills were so rare they could not be spared whether they had been good or bad. Without the artist, we had no map-making section. I suspect that if the artist had had a violation against him, they would have barred him under that pretext, just as I suspect that someone high in command was a believer in Smedley Butler's axiom about brig rats. In retrospect, it is easy to forgive my commanders this. But then, it was hard. It was too much like being unfairly condemned to death. The injustice of it overwhelmed me, and I burned with a resentment that was dangerous to carry around. When the departure of the lucky ones was succeeded by a period of the most rigid discipline, I resolved to get away from Pavuvu to a place of solace and rest, where I might recover my equilibrium. What better place than the hospital across the bay on Banika? The episode with Lieutenant Big Picture had shown me how a flight to the hospital, like a retreat to the wilderness, could solve my problems. Why not try it again? Because of the rain, falling daily even though the rainy season was supposed to have ended, my enuresis was more noticeable than before. Perhaps, too, the agitation of the moment aggravated it. I know that the men in my tent had been urging me to report it to sickbay. I did. The doctor, who knew of my case, ordered me to Banika. I was to leave in the morning. I walked back from sickbay with a sense of grim satisfaction and strode into my tent to find Rutherford sitting on my cot. Suddenly the palms in the tropic night had vanished, and I was standing in front of the bank on Station Square at home. Many a Saturday night, Rutherford and I and the others had stood there, rehashing the high school football game. He had joined the Marines the same month I did, and had been assigned to the 5th Regiment. I had not seen him since New River. He grinned cheerfully, and I said,
"You no good. How come you didn't go home on rotation?"
Rutherford chuckled. "I wasn't a good boy, I guess." "Same here," I said. And then as he drew a huge Japanese pistol from beneath his coat, "What the hell you got there?" He looked around furtively and thrust it beneath the blanket. "Keep it for me, will you?" he said. "I clipped it from the company commander this morning, and he's raising hell about it. They're gonna have a shakedown tomorrow." His round, sallow face darkened. "It's mine, anyway. That lousy captain pulled rank and took it from me. I got it from a Jap major at Talisaya. He killed himself with it." "Give it to me," I said. "I'm going to the hospital on Banika tomorrow, and I'll take it with me." His eyes glowed. "Good. They can shake down the whole damn island tomorrow, and they'll never find it." Rutherford left, immensely relieved. In the morning, I hung Rutherford's machine pistol underneath my armpit by means of a length of white cord, put my coat over it, picked up my bag of toilet gear, and went down to the division hospital. From there, a landing boat took me to Banika. Banika was a flesh pot. Banika was the big town. Banika was Broadway. Banika had women. It had buildings of steel and wood. It had roads. It had thousands of sailors as sleek as capons. It had movie amphitheaters. It had electric lights. It had canteens overflowing with candy and comforts. And Banika had beer. Walking with the others from the beach to the Navy hospital, I felt like a hick on his first visit to New York. Jeeps and trucks and staff cars swept over the island's roads, raising a busy cloud of dust. Cranes croaked and cranked on the beach, loading and unloading the boats. MPs patrolled a stockade of pointed sticks behind which dwelt the women, the Navy nurses and Red Cross workers. Everyone was well-fed and unworried. The seat of every pair of pants was well-filled and happy. Banika was a bovine buttocks. We lean ones who wore our discontent on our faces and carried our nervous impatience in our hands must have been a disturbing presence in that purring island incubator. Yet, as I walked along, I was filled with the uneasy suspicion that it would be the image of Banika and not Pavuvu that would be presented to America as the Pacific War. I thought of a USO singer whom I had known before the war, who had entertained us at New River. She had asked to see me, and when I was fetched, we walked about our barren base. "What do you think of it?" I asked. And she, perhaps thinking of other bases she had visited, shiny with brass and gay with military balls, she had looked down her nose at our poor tents and huts and said,
not very glamorous.
Pavuvu was like New River. Like every place we had been. Not very glamorous. But Banika. There was glamour for you. This was war in the Pacific. This was what America would hear. A Navy corpsman led me into a ward and off into a side room. A little cell.
Take off your clothes,
he said, coldly throwing pajamas and robe at me. Clearly the duty was distasteful to him. I started to comply.
Give me your belt and your razor blades, he said.
It was an odd command, but I obeyed. I was still undressing, and my eyes traveled to the window. It was barred. Belt? Blades? Bars? Where was I? The corpsman intercepted my gaze and said,
This is just the overflow ward. There isn't any room right now in the ward you're supposed to go to.
I nodded, but I did not believe him. I examined him. His face was still white with the pallor of civilization. He could not have been long out of the States. He was young, too. Above all, he had the sneering look of the sailor who finds it painful to associate with foot sloggers. I remembered Rutherford's pistol under my arm. I had not yet taken off my coat, and I delayed it till last, waiting until the corpsman had gathered up my belt and shaving gear and had started to leave the cell for the overflow ward. I drew the pistol, shucked the coat, and then, standing naked, pointed the pistol at him, and said, Hey! He turned, exasperated, saw the huge pistol pointed at him, and stood transfixed. I remained silent and motionless. It was pleasant to see the look of superiority fade from his face, to see the tongue flick out nervously like a lizard's. If I was in the nut ward, as I was, if they thought me crazy, as they thought all Marines, I would play the part to the hilt and enjoy it. A nude nut brandishing a blunderbuss. At last I said, What shall I do of this? He was too weak to reply, so I went on, Here, you better take it and store it in the hospital property for me or something. He took it gingerly and left. Poor superior fool. He had not the sense to determine if it was loaded or not. Which it wasn't. In faded pajamas and red robe, I went out in the ward. The first man I encountered stopped me and said, I'm going to a party tonight and I've got to get my brain polished up. Would you mind holding it until I get a cloth? I knew where I was now. Overflow ward. Sure, I said, humoring him. Hand it over. He placed his hands to his head, cupped them, affected to deposit something in my hands, scurried off, returned with a handkerchief, retrieved his brains, mumbled, Thanks a lot, and betook himself outdoors to a little caged enclosure where he fluttered his handkerchief busily while murmuring nonsense to himself. I watched him for a few moments, hoping that he would raise his head and burst into laughter. But he did not. He was really insane. At the end of the brightly sunlit ward were tables on which the inmates could read, write, or play games. Two men sat there now, playing cards. I came up and sat down. After a time, I jerked my head in the direction of the brain polisher and asked, What the hell's the matter with him? He's nuts, they said in scornful unison, neither looking up from his cards. Silence. I spoke again timidly. What ward is this? P-38 ward, they said irritably. I gathered that P-38 ward was the lingo for mental ward. Perhaps because many of its patients were certain that they could fly. The card players had stopped their game and were examining me attentively, as though waiting for me to expostulate, But what am I doing here? Rather than gratify them, I arose and wandered down to the other end of the room. There, in a glass-enclosed cubicle, sat the Navy nurse. Hygienic, unfriendly. She would never lift a finger to nurse a man. The corpsman would do the nursing. The nurse would keep the records. So far from being angels of mercy in the Pacific, Navy nurses were recording angels. They were accountants. They surveyed us from the eminence of their rank. For they were not nurses and we patients. They were lieutenants and we enlisted men, dirty-mouthed, half-crazy Marines to boot. We wished the Navy nurses to hell and gone, to anywhere but in the hospitals, where they got in the corpsman's way and infuriated the patients. At the moment, a chubby patient was pestering her to look at a choice piece of pornography smuggled into him by some well-meaning nitwit. I was to learn later that sex was this man's problem, as it was for many of them. She pretended to admire it and got rid of him. Then she saw me, and her frosty look made me determined to play my part again. "Nurse," I said, looking at her fixedly, "I'd like to have my razor blades back." "Why?" she countered, concerned. "I want to settle a grudge." She gazed at me in astonishment, and I returned her stare. She wrote the request down, as though she were recording a mortal sin in the Book of Judgment, and I walked away satisfied. To hell with them all. If they thought I was a nut, all right, I'll be a nut, at least until I see the psychiatrist. I saw him the next day. He regarded me good-humoredly as I came into his office and took the seat opposite him. "What's this about razor blades?"
"What?"
"Oh, I was just kidding, sir." "I know you were," he said, looking at me reprovingly. "But don't do it again, eh? You got the nurse all upset." "Yes, sir." It was difficult not to vent my vexation at having been placed in the P-38 ward, rather than in some place which seemed more likely to cure my weak kidneys, as I called it. But I stayed silent, watching Dr. Gentle as he bent, grunting, to give me the hammer test. This was to strike a patient's crossed leg just below the knee to measure the speed of his reflexes. He was intent upon it, and I could study him. Square. Powerful. Squareness in body, hands and head, with power throughout. He was bald, a man of about 50. Gentleness of manner and speech seemed to approach the effeminate, an impression fortified by a certain oversupple softness of face and body. But it was a bad impression to act upon, although it might have been deliberately cultivated by Dr. Gentle for just that purpose, to beguile the patient off his guard in order to learn more about his character. He began the routine psychiatric examination, and from it I deduced that he was a Freudian. The majority of his questions, and all of his preliminary queries, were based upon sex. He sought abnormality. Then he asked of my childhood. Finally, after 15 minutes, he concluded his interview, and since I seemed to be regarding him with the intentness of the accused awaiting the judge's verdict, he said, "Just take it easy. You're going to be here for a month at least, and we're probably going to see a lot of each other. So relax. As far as I can see, you seem to be all right. A bit hot-tempered, but..."
"What do you mean, hot-tempered?"
I blazed out at him. He smiled, and I might have felt foolish had I not seen the humor in it. That I was like the man running about in a frenzy, exclaiming, "Who's excited? Who's excited?" After a lifetime spent in denial of my hot temper, it was a relief to acknowledge it. He began to question me about my experiences in the war, and, as I told them to him, he shook his head from side to side, as though to indicate that my whole division, not only myself, ought to be psychoanalyzed. Then we talked of books, for he was well-read, and philosophy. Suddenly he broke it off and said, "What did you say you were?" "A scout," I said proudly. "I used to be a machine gunner." "But that's no place for a man of your caliber." Now I was shocked. The old shibboleth, intelligence. Had not our government been culpable enough in pampering the high IQ draftees as though they were too intelligent to fight for their country? Could not Dr. Gentle see that I was proud to be a scout, and before that a machine gunner? Intelligence, intelligence, intelligence. Keep it up, America.